Congressional Republicans appear to be on the verge of not tanking the global economy after all. The joys, it says here, of presenter-free radio, and would you live in a lighthouse? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. It's Friday, so it's our weekly in-house daily, and the Monocle staffers who followed the sign saying free money this way before we shut the studio door behind them are Lillian Fawcett, Isabella Jewell and Carolina Abbott-Galvao. They'll discuss the day's stuff and we'll have a report from the Lisbon Art Fair. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Monocle Radio's associate producers Isabella Jewell and Lillian Fawcett. Hello to you both.
Good evening.
Lillian, first of all, as regular listeners will be aware, assuming they are also sufficiently dedicated as to hang in there until the closing credits, you very regularly produce this program. You are today on the other side of the glass. So my first question is, how do you reckon Tom Webb is doing so far?
I think he's doing a pretty good job. You know, you get into routines with particular shows, a work pattern, you know, but I think he's going places.
You're usually phoning it in, is what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, you always think you're right about everything, which on the whole I am. But I think, you know, if Tom really sticks at it, he could really go somewhere in this profession.
Yeah. Well, you know, early days, but we shall keep an eye on him. He does show some signs of promise.
Sometimes.
Isabella, how are you enjoying so far being a daily panellist, given that you haven't actually said anything yet?
Well, I absolutely love it, and it's fascinating to watch the youngest child syndrome exuding from Lillian here.
What does that mean?
What does that actually mean?
No comment.
Okay, well, we will hear more from both of you fairly shortly, but we are going to do one of the seamless gear changes from light introductory banter to serious news, for which this show is justly famed. And we're going to go to the United States, where the White House and congressional Republicans appear to be edging to the concluding stages of the deeply tedious ritual in which congressional Republicans threaten to not raise the U.S. government's debt ceiling, thereby triggering a default and a global economic crisis before deciding not to. As of this broadcast, both sides are making optimistic noises about getting something nailed down before everyone goes home for the Memorial Day holiday. I'm joined with more on this by Monocle's Washington, D.C. correspondent, Chris Chermer. Chris, what is the latest? Is the global economy going to be saved from disaster, or this time next week, will we all be wearing barrels with straps?
Oh my, Andrew, who can say, to be honest? As you alluded to, there is talk, whispers of a deal in the works that could happen today. It could also happen tomorrow, the day after, or the day after that. Between the White House and Kevin McCarthy's team, he's the Speaker of the House of Representatives. But that said, so I should say, the outlines of that deal are essentially that there would be a freeze on spending, a sort of a freeze on spending at levels of this year, which would be a pretty big concession from the White House and Joe Biden towards Republicans. But that said, I think the key thing, aside from whether these two will reach some kind of deal today, tomorrow, or the next day, just before or after the Memorial Day weekend here, is then whether this can actually get through Congress. And there are a number of people who are frustrated on both sides, frankly, in Congress that, you know, one or the other gave away the farm, as it were. Either, you know, Kevin McCarthy is not agreeing to stiff enough spending cuts from the Republican side, or Joe Biden is agreeing to too many. So it remains to be seen what happens next and whether any deal that is reached between these two actually gets through Congress next week.
Well, Chris, as we have discussed before about similar subjects in similar circumstances, Kevin McCarthy's majority, the Republican majority that is in Congress, is a very, very slender one. And quite a lot of it is comprised of people who are, well, let's call them mildly eccentric in their approach to economics and politics generally. Are there people holding him hostage who would actually be quite up for a default and the chaos that would ensue?
There are absolutely people holding Kevin McCarthy hostage and would be quite in favor of sort of coming down to the wire on this, or even going beyond the deadline that the Treasury Department has set, saying that, you know, June 1st is the day where the U.S. could potentially default on its debts. That said, Andrew, what's interesting about this, and a little bit different compared to some other pieces of legislation, if you will, is that, you know, if there is a deal on this between the White House and Kevin McCarthy, then it's kind of up to Kevin McCarthy as well to say, I'm going to put this forward. I'm going to put this forward in the House of Representatives. If he does that, well, then Democrats can vote for it too. So he's not necessarily held hostage, if you will, to those few Republicans, 10, 20, 30, 40, who might revolt based on the deal that he reaches. But he has to go for that. And that's what, of course, this is where the politics also comes into this, because if Kevin McCarthy is deemed weak and seen as having done a deal that favors the White House too much, then yes, maybe it gets through Congress because Democrats vote for it as well, and some Republicans do. But it could spell the end of Kevin McCarthy's speakership, because, of course, he would then potentially face a challenge to his standing as speaker. So that's kind of the politics that go into this, as well as the simple question of whether there will be a default by the U.S. or not.
Well, we will, of course, keep an eye on that across the weekend. But while we have you here, we should talk about the week's other big political development in the United States, which was, well, launch doesn't seem quite the right word for the beginning of Ron DeSantis' campaign for the presidency. Has he recovered from it yet?
Oh, that's a good question, Andrew. I mean, I think, look, there's 7 months or more than 7 months until the first actual votes in the Republican primary for who they want as their next presidential nominee. So there is a risk of making too much of things like a botched campaign announcement, as this week's by Ron DeSantis on Twitter was. I did try to follow it, by the way. I got booted off, like many people, from the Twitter conversation that he was having, the Twitter Spaces conversation. So there's too much that you can make of it. But that said, you know, Ron DeSantis, of course, starts at actually a disadvantage at the moment compared to Donald Trump. Donald Trump is the front runner in the polls. Ron DeSantis polls around 15 to 20% typically in the polls that you look at. That's not bad, but it's not Donald Trump, who typically has 30, 40, 50% in the polls, depending on how you measure it. So any misstep by him, and there have been a few now ahead of his official campaign announcement, risks, you know, undermining that hopeful side, the investors, the people, the campaign financiers that were looking to him as the main alternative to Donald Trump. Can he recover from that? It's hard to say. One other thing I'll say on that as well, just to give you a sign of the uphill battle, Donald Trump put out, of course, an ad quite quickly against Ron DeSantis and essentially calls him Trump light, you know, and sort of that's been a lot of the focus so far of the attack ads against Ron DeSantis. So he's going to have to show that he is his own man. He has his own policies, and he is going to have to take the fight to Donald Trump. The stumbling this week suggests that he's going to have a bit of a hard time doing that.
Chris Chermak in Washington, D.C., thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle Radio. Let's go back to our panel, Lillian and Isabella, and we will look at an innovation in broadcasting which could spell doom for us all, should it turn out that people would rather listen to the twittering of birds and whisper of wind than the intellectually rigorous and philosophically subtle discourse which characterises the Monocle Daily. Not for nothing, currently the 31st most popular daily news podcast in Kazakhstan, and that's down 13 places from yesterday. A new audio service launched by the University of Sussex intends to broadcast the sounds of local nature around the clock. It will be called Wilding Radio, it says here. Isabella, first of all, what is the difference between this and opening the window?
Well, as the resident country bumpkin of the office,
that's
I think. Yeah, I guess that might be the reason that you'd come to me first. Look, from an outsider perspective, I think you'd all feel a lot happier and a lot more relaxed if you had a little bit of the sounds of the countryside. If you open your window in London, you're going to get the screams of ambulances, maybe the odd wild, you know, city fox that's kind of pushing over someone's bin, maybe the sounds of people fighting drunk, as, you know, the tweeting of baby birds, the grunting of a badger, you know, it's a different ballgame.
Lillian, do you fear that this may threaten the Monocle Daily's place in the hearts of Kazakhstani podcast listeners?
Not if I have anything to do with it, obviously. But also, I have to ask, what kind of turbulence is happening in the Kazakh podcast charts that the Daily has moved down 13 places in a day?
It's mayhem.
Clearly, I think there's obviously been an influx of daily news podcasts in Kazakhstan, or maybe they took inspiration from us. Maybe, though. I mean, I don't know what the kind of natural landscape is like in Kazakhstan, but just speaking personally, as very much not a country bumpkin, and if I open my window, I am lucky to hear the dog down the street barking. It likes to do it quite late at night, quite persistently. And I might get a few pigeons, but I love listening to nature. And actually, I love it so much that sometimes when I'm walking through Regent's Park in the morning, I'm very lucky that my walk to work is a walk through Regent's Park, which is a lovely park the north of London, quite near to our studio. I get kind of the sounds of nature and I find it delightful. I find it really fills my soul. It's so nice. And sometimes my mum is very lucky because she gets her own nature radio direct from me, because sometimes I'm just like, oh, I need to record this. So I take a little recording and I send it to her, which I actually think we can hear a little bit of now.
That is Regent's Park for real. Isabella, does that meet your exacting country bumpkin standards?
Oh, you can definitely tell those are city birds rather than the real thing. Honestly, it's the rumble in the back. It was a beautiful track, don't get me wrong. I think you could definitely take on Worlding Radio. But it's that rumble in the back you don't get in the countryside. Where I live, there's loads of red kites. I think we're the red kite hotspot of the UK. So sometimes it does feel like being in Jurassic Park with these kind of terrifying squawks across the skyline.
Well, see, this is one of my reservations about the Wilding Radio project, is that not all sounds made by nature are necessarily relaxing. And there would be issues, I think, with the Australian equivalent of this. On the one hand, some of it will be lovely. You will get the incredibly intricate trilling of the Australian magpie, which is a lovely, lovely sound, as opposed to the absolutely appalling squawk made by its British cousin. But you might also happen across the laugh of the kookaburra, which, while charming in its way, I can tell you from personal experience, is not necessarily the sort of thing you want to hear delivered from your windowsill at circa 6 o'clock in the morning when you only got in a few hours before that.
Can we have an impression? Because I'm not sure that many people outside of Australia would have any clue
what
we're talking about.
I think you really need to paint a picture for us, such.
I am not going to do an impression of the kookaburra's laugh, but I can tell our listeners that there is a great deal of it on YouTube. But from the broadcasting perspective, Lillian, where do you see the appeal of this kind of thing? Because they're pitching this within the framework of slow broadcasting, akin to those TV broadcasts, which are like 15 hours of somebody else's open fire or pictures taken out of a train window and broadcast for days, and which apparently people do watch.
Yes. Yeah, they do. I think I kind of summed it up, to be honest, because, like I said, if I open my window, I might get a pigeon or a fox, or if I'm lucky, when I'm walking through Regent's Park, I get some birds. But as Bella pointed out, you never get away from the urban sounds when you're in London. But sometimes it's nice. It's kind of a form of escapism. It can be very calming. And actually, I did do a bit of research into this. I came prepared for this very broadcast, and I found out that even just listening to nature sounds, so obviously being in nature is incredibly good for you. It's very good for your mental well-being, for your stress levels. But even just listening to nature sounds can be also have that effect. And a University of Chicago study actually found that participants in their study who listened to nature sounds, such as crickets chirping and waves crashing, I don't know if they tested out a kookaburra or an urban fox, but they performed better on demanding cognitive tests than people who listen to urban sounds like traffic and the clatter of a busy cafe. So it will expand our brains as well as relax us, I think.
Is it possible, Isabella, just finally on this, that what's actually going on there is a sort of compensating thing? Like people in the city need to listen to the sounds of nature, whereas perhaps a similar radio station broadcasting to the settlement in which you grow up could play traffic and drunks brawling in the streets and the sounds of the city, giving you what you're missing.
This is very interesting. Firstly, I'd like that you described it as a settlement. It makes me feel like Boudicca or something. I've come in painted completely blue. That's what I'm doing today. That's an interesting one. Perhaps we do need a little dose of London. I mean, the thing is, what I would pitch to you is you all need a bit of the taste of the countryside, because every morning when I come in, people go, Bella, why are you so positive and cheerful today? And I go, well, it's because I've just been on a beautiful bus ride through the countryside and seen all the lovely glowing yellow fields. Do I perhaps need a little bit of the city edge? Probably. I think that, for example, the sounds of a busy cafe, I quite like that. That was always kind of nice background sound when I was studying at university. It does kind of ground you slightly. And perhaps those of us who do live in greener rural areas do need to have a little bit more anger about us, because we can be a bit annoying and positive sometimes. And a touch of the real world could be a really good way to expand our minds. The only thing that I'm interested about this radio station is what's to stop really grumpy hikers or a couple breaking up over a picnic from being caught on the microphone.
But no one could break up in the countryside because they're all just so happy exactly. to be absorbing all of these natural noises.
We don't have any problems in the countryside.
Famously. Well, we will move on to a related sort of subject, because the issues of the joys and the drawbacks of living remotely do pertain to this story. And this is a real estate opportunity with considerable upsides, equally daunting drawbacks, and not a great deal in between. So the good news, it's cheap, indeed possibly free. The sea views are outstanding and it's certainly quiet. The bad news is the locations are not massively convenient and there would be an amount of upkeep involved. The US government is seeking to offload another 10 lighthouses made redundant by advances in modern navigation technology. Examples include the Cleveland Harbour West Pierhead Lighthouse on Lake Erie and the Stratford Shoal Light in the middle of Long Island Sound. Lillian, first of all, are you tempted in theory by the idea of living in a lighthouse?
I like the idea of it. I'd like to say that I could just be really self-sufficient and have a little plot of land and maybe some chickens and just sort of do everything myself. And I think I would be happy with that for a few hours. And then I would think, oh, I actually would quite like a pint, or I need some milk and I'd have to milk a cow or something. And that doesn't really appeal to me. Maybe as a little holiday home, maybe if just the urban noise is getting so overwhelming. I mean, it's going to be very quiet out there, isn't it?
Well,
so I also like a project. So maybe regrettably have signed up for a 10K, because I think I needed like a structured hobby.
That would come in handy, because that is about how far you would have to go to get a pint of milk.
Exactly. Yeah. So I could do my 10K and also have a kind of hobby, something to fill my time, because I've just got so much free time in this job, because, you know, it's so easy. I just need something to do.
Well, exactly. Isabella, we are just going to carry on cheerfully stereotyping you as somebody who basically grew up, I don't know, let's say 50 kilometres from the nearest paved road. So you do have some insight into what living in a remote locale is like. Mm-hmm. Are you tempted by any of these?
Well, I tell you what, it really depends on the shape of the lighthouse, because, you know, often they're round. And I just think, how would you find any furniture that fits against the wall?
I mean, there must be people who specialise in lighthouse furniture.
There must be, but I'm sure the expense would then kind of balance out to the point that it would be as expensive as a kind of reasonably placed place of living. It is tempting. The only thing as well that puts me off is, if you ever had a party with kind of a complex lighting system, would you be confusing a lot of the boats in the nearby body of water?
How often do you have parties with complex lighting systems?
I don't go far beyond.
It's wild out there in the sticks, obviously.
It really, really is. We have to do something to keep ourselves occupied. Otherwise, you know, what's the point of even living?
Everyone gets together on a Friday night to watch the traffic light. I did want to try and bring this down to a plausible test case, because there is a lighthouse which is or was very recently for sale here in the United Kingdom, and the thing is, you get quite a spread for your money. It's 150,000 quid it was advertised at, which would not buy you very much at all in London. Whereas in the far, far north of Scotland, on Strathy Point, in fact, it gets you... I mean, it kind of looks like a compound. You could start, well, you could have your own, for example, pirate radio station here, perhaps broadcasting birdsong, or you could start a cult. I'm not going to say I'm tempted, but I mean, it's a spectacular setting.
The options are significant. You could do a lot with that property. Mm. And as you say, yeah, I think that would get you maybe a garden shed if you're lucky, mm-hmm, in London, maybe with a window if you're looking at kind of zone four, zone five. I've been thinking about this. I like the idea of it. Scotland is very beautiful.
It is.
And I think you would never get over opening the window in the mornings and just seeing, you know, the remote Scottish countryside. However, it is very cold up there. It rains a lot. I think almost every morning when I listen to the weather forecast, they'll say bright blue sunny skies. It's going to be 20 degrees across most of the UK apart from northern Scotland. So that would get me down a bit. However, I also have been looking into this and the remoteness of it. Again, I think I would enjoy it for a few hours maybe. But then I might say want to meet some other people, mm-hmm, see some friends. And I might want to go to Glasgow or Edinburgh, which are, as our international listeners, I'm sure will know, are the two big cities in Scotland. So I had a look. The nearest train station is one called Forsenard. It's 17 miles away from this house, by the way. So even that's not close. I mean, I'm not running there. And from there to Edinburgh Waverley, which is the main train station at Edinburgh, it's going to take you more than 7 hours and you actually have to change trains. And to Glasgow, it also takes about that long. You have to change twice and it costs 60 quid. And with how British trains are running at the moment, you can't even assume that it's going to turn up on time or at all. And then I thought, what if I wanted to pop home to Bristol to see my family? Which... again, for our international listeners, that's about the entire length of the country. Mm-hmm. That would take 15 hours and cost £250. So I think unless I have a really big falling out with my whole family and all my friends, it's probably not looking like a goer for me.
Isabella, what do you think?
Well, I have checked this property out on the internet and there would be a lot of work needed on the interior design. It is a square-shaped building rather than a round one.
There's that.
So there's that. You know, you could do it fairly easily, but it does look a little bit prison-esque at the moment. There's some work that's needing, you know, to be done. The main issue I would have with this area, or kind of any kind of moving somewhere very remote, is I feel like there's been a trend of very remote places advertising to the whole world for someone not from there to move in. For example, there's always islands going, saying, oh, we've got loads of sheep. Can someone please move here as a shepherd? And then someone from London who's previously worked in the city decides to go over there. I just don't think the people there would like you. Maybe it's because I am from a village and we're a little bit unfriendly to outsiders, to continue the stereotype. I just think if I went up to Scotland as a southerner and kind of imposed myself and my lifestyle on them, they would end up hating me, like how the whole of Lisbon hates the digital nomads. It's it's not really an ideal kind of situation for making friends, I feel. It always works in the films. There's always an American moving to some village in Ireland and falling for the pub landlord. In reality, does that actually work?
Like I said, I think it would have to be a kind of, you've fallen out with all your friends and family and you just decide to live a complete hermit, ascetic lifestyle. You milk your own cows, you have chickens, maybe a couple of pigs, and that's kind of you set. I think that would be the only way it would work.
I did want to ask you both, finally, what is the remotest place you have ever actually stayed? Isabella, obviously, in your case, I'm going to have to qualify with that with other than your own house, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, once I did stay in an Airbnb built on top of the tomb of Ibn Battuta in Tangier. So, notoriously, the Moroccan explorer that everyone has heard of course. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't so remote in that, you know, Tangier is a bustling, lively city, but it was in the middle of the Medina, down tiny little passageways. You really couldn't find it unless you laid a trail of breadcrumbs. And if you did that, you'd be mobbed by seagulls the whole way. And in fact, once a seagull fully blocked our entrance to this little Airbnb by just sitting on the doorstep. And that kind of gives a sense of how wide the alleyway was there. So I think that's the place that felt the most remote to me.
Apart from getting mugged by seagulls. Lillian?
Well, in the UK, I'll start with, and obviously we have to... factor in that in the UK you're never that far away from civilization, even in on the most northern point of Scotland. I've done a couple of holidays in the Scottish Highlands near Loch Ness and Loch Lomond, which are very beautiful, but they were kind of in town, so you could get an ice cream or a pint or a loaf of bread or whatever. But I also did a 2.5 week trek in Borneo in the jungle. And because I was doing a very stereotypical British student before they go to university gap year. And I did a jungle trek. Bella asked me before we came on air, was I doing it on my own? Very much not. We had guides, and they were those kind of people where you're kind of thinking, oh my God, this is the hardest thing I've done in my whole life. And they're doing it in flip flops, just kind of, and they run up and down the mountain carrying things for you. It was just amazing. So that was pretty remote. That was kind of so remote that there was no plumbing or anything like that. I think for me that was 2.5 weeks probably my limit. I also did a holiday in Joshua Tree National Park in California, which was quite amazing. It was almost kind of like Mars, if Mars had a few trees. But we stayed in an Airbnb that had, the air conditioning was broken.
Oh my God.
And when you're somewhere that remote, and it's 40 degrees Celsius, and the air conditioning's broken, it was quite miserable. We ended up calling it the Sweat Lodge. And you also can't call a plumber. An electrician at, you know, whatever time of night. I think living in London, you get so used to just being able to have anything you want on demand at any time. So that also, for me, I think was a bit remote. I think I'll stick with North London for now and just get my nature sounds from the park.
Or indeed, Radio Wilding, apparently. Lillian Fawcett and Isabella Jewell, thank you both for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle Radio. The current issue of Monocle magazine is on a newsstand near you right about now, and among the many things in it is a report from the Haystack Mountain School of Crafts, the island retreat off the coast of Maine. And I'm joined now by the writer of that report, Monocle writer Carolina Abbott-Galvao. Well, first of all, if you would, explain what the Haystack Mountain School of Crafts actually is.
Yeah, so it's a place in this really small, well, it's not even in a town really, but it's in this really small island off Maine. And it's somewhere artists and designers and makers can really go to, you know, participate in open studio residencies and take part in workshops and just really become better at their craft and really just take the time to really focus on their work in this really beautiful place.
It is, and I have had a look at the map, quite a long way from anywhere. Is the isolation part of the appeal, and how romantic did that still seem to you towards the end of the bus trip to get there?
So, you know, yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. One thing they like to say there is that it's, you know, quiet by design. And I think that certainly was the intention when the architects were planning that. Yeah, it took me a while to get there because I can't drive. And so it was a very long bus ride. And actually, by the time I got there, I was just really glad to be there because it was such a long journey. And I was like, you know what? I'll stay here. I like it.
The feature you wrote is for the Me and My Cabinet section of Monocle, in which we talk to a team who run a particular enterprise. For the people who work there, what is the appeal of it? Because it's clearly quite a commitment. You have planted yourself in the middle of nowhere to help other people nurture their artistic dreams.
Yeah, I think what was really cool and what I noticed when I was there is that because it's in such a remote place, that really allows people to, you know, create these really tight-knit bonds with each other. And they really do have this really small community of amazing, creative, and cool people there. And I imagine that when people do come in, people participating in the workshops and taking part in the open studio residencies, it's I can imagine that they become a part of that community as well, which is, you know, I think that's really the appeal.
Who is it for, though, the school? Is it for already semi-established or established artists, or is it for people who basically just quite fancy a crack at it?
Both, really. I think it's open to everyone. You have to know, I mean, there are teachers that will teach you how to use the equipment, but it isn't, you don't have to be like a super big name to be able to get that opportunity or to even, you know, participate in the courses and in the workshops and get the studios. And, you know, so it is quite Yeah, it's not something that's super exclusive.
And on the bus ride back, did you find yourself thinking you would one day like to get the bus ride back in the other direction and enroll as a student and perhaps make a pot?
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of thought I was just going to stay there, really. I was like, I didn't really want to go back.
Well, on that vote of confidence for your workplace and your colleagues, Carolina Abbott-Galvao, thank you very much.
Find me in Maine next week. I won't be coming back into the office.
Thank you very much for joining us.
All right.
And finally, on today's show, Lisbon Design Week is in full swing, a celebration of creativity, high craft and design over 5 days in the Portuguese capital. For a flavour of what to expect, we sent Monocle's Gaia Lutz to take a look.
I've been living in Lisbon. I arrived actually almost 10 years ago when nobody was here. It was like a ghost city. Well, it was as charming as it is today, but there was nothing happening, not really, unless you were really into deep culture, which was very difficult for foreigners.
That's the Belgian Julie Dehaloum, one half of the duo behind Lisbon Design Week, a new event which kicked off yesterday in the Portuguese capital. Julie didn't exactly come from the world of design. She worked in real estate before, and perhaps because she was working at that intersection between business, aesthetics, and lifestyle, that she noticed a bit of a gap in the market when it came to Lisbon's design scene.
I understood that there was something to do, and also something to show, because the way the craftsmen people and designers were presented was not enough, I think, for Portugal. I think they don't have like a marketing view of what they have to sell, and I wanted to link those people in those projects, what they could have, they could produce, to the business, the real estate people, the hotel business, the hospitality in general, which I love.
These thoughts led Julie to create Lisbon by Design 3 years ago, an annual fair showcasing a selection of Portugal-based designers and craftspeople to a wider public. This year, the idea was to go bigger.
To extend the idea of the fair within the city and doing something really urban, something visible and something really for the city.
For this expansion, Julie joined forces with fellow Belgian Michel Fachman, who had a background in law and creative placemaking. It was late last year when they decided to launch Lisbon Design Week.
It took us a long time to really sit and decide. And in fact, the challenge was really, shall we start for this year or not? Because it was already late in the year. We had very little really money to launch this project and little time. But we had the feeling, and strong feeling as far as I'm concerned, that the momentum was right.
Together, Julie and Michel started mapping out the people, ateliers, brands and institutions that would make up the first edition of Lisbon Design Week and what they wanted the event to represent.
The focus was Portugal. So this was very important to us, not to do something too commercial, not to do something international brands showing their new collection. No, it was going to Portugal, what's done in Portugal.
I think also what we have noticed is that in terms of the design sector, although there is, like we said, no representation of this sector, and really we have the feeling that there are some groups and some cliques that were sometimes not encouraged to participate to some of the events, and so we can feel that, and we want to be very inclusive. We have opened the door to many.
We want the visitors to have surprises, even if they know, some people know very well the city, know the designers, the craftsmen people, they will be surprised, because we also are opening some studios that nobody entered. We asked the artists to do some demonstration workshops. They're going to be like a glass blowing demonstration. We asked them to do some performances, also parties, because it has to be fun. Designers get together. So many, many things that don't really exist at the moment and that we pushed the participant to organize.
The program for the following 3 days is packed. Designers will be showcasing their work in 50 locations across Lisbon, be it their own ateliers or different shops or hotels. There are also talks, cocktail parties and workshops on the agenda. I started my day early today to get as much in as I could. With my Lisbon Design Week map in hand, I headed to the light-dappled studio in the neighborhood of Santos first.
Yeah, I'm Bryony Person in Person and Miller.
And I'm Wanda Miller.
We've been coming for 20 years, but we moved 4 or 5 years ago to Lisbon, setting up a ceramic studio, and this will be our fourth ceramic studio together.
Bryony Person and Wanda Miller create contemporary ceramics, chiefly using stoneware and porcelain. The duo shared other studios in Spain before settling in Lisbon. From plates to pots, sculptures and lighting, everything exhibited in their workshop is unique. And although they collaborate on some pieces, both have distinct styles of working with ceramics.
The world of ceramics is so diverted. So many techniques and things you can do, and you never have enough time to learn and do all the things you really want to do. And so, yeah, we try to experiment, and Bryony does mostly the wheel. She works on the wheel. And I worked hand-built ceramics. That's what I like. And we,
Wanda has got a lot more patience. She's a lot more precise, and she likes to really take her time and do things in her way. And I'm here. You can see me now. You don't. I like to. Mine's an explosion of activity. Well, tomorrow Wanda will be giving a demonstration workshop on textures and ceramics. So it's an open workshop for people to come and learn techniques.
The workshop is just a little demonstration of what you can do with different, how to make textures and play around a bit, mess around. It's not a proper workshop for that. You need time to prepare and then fire it and all that and decorate, whatever. But it gives you an idea what you can do, how you can play around with clay and the results, and they're really instant and using really simple things. So it's just to get your hands dirty, I guess.
Not far from Person and Miller, also in Santurce, is Paris Sece. For many years, Paris Sece has been the reference when it comes to a design retailer in Portugal. I caught up with Sara Brito at the shop.
So my father founded the company in 1985, so we take really great pride in almost 40 years of history. As you say, it's a legacy, so we try to honor that. We're built on the classics and try to basically epitomize what is best done in the design industry. Basically, we are dedicated to a lifestyle, to a way of living, which, of course, we all talk about sustainability, and we advocate that sustainability relies also in having things that stay with you for life.
From Vitra to USM, Fritz Hansen to Artec, Paris Sece brings a selection of the crème de la crème of international design to Portugal. For Lisbon Design Week, they took the opportunity of Arco, the contemporary arts fair which is also happening in town this week, to showcase the works of two Portuguese artists alongside their collection of design classics.
We really find that lifestyle and design and arts is a combination of multiple elements. And that, of course, it goes from furniture to interior design to, of course, art pieces, photography. And that's what we try to materialize in this space. Basically, we dedicated this space, the entrance of the store, to showcase Inês Norton and to showcase Pedro Duarte Jorge. And that's it. So we find it very cool to dedicate this day to showcase not only what we do for the past 35 or 37 almost years, but also to, I don't know, represent what's been going on.
The thing about Lisbon's burgeoning design scene is that it is still, well, burgeoning and small. Even when it comes to the more established names, nothing is happening in a silo. There's especially a lot of dialogue happening between this new generation of creatives, be them artists, designers, craftsmen, or even entrepreneurs. Portugal, let's remember, is a small country, which makes it a great place for collaborations. And even ateliers and studios themselves seem to have a multidisciplinary approach that draws on skills from throughout the country.
So this is the fourth collection. It's bronze and beeswax. It started with Noé wanted to explore the work with the bronze. And he contacted Fundibronze, that is a factory that made propellers for ships.
That's the designer, Fernanda. She's giving me a tour of Made in Situ, the Lisbon studio and project, helmed by the French designer Noé Duchafour-Laurence. Since moving to Lisbon, Noé's been involved in projects very much rooted in Portugal, its craftspeople and its nature. For Lisbon Design Week, the studio's showcasing their fourth collection, entitled Bronze and Beeswax, which encompasses the dozen of squared, minimalistic bronze candle holders which are at display around me.
We work with another company here close in Sintra, and it's Oliver Antunes. And they did all the patina for the pieces. As you can see, it's all the pieces, it's the same material. It's a piece of bronze, but it has two different finishings. The inside, it's a polishing, so they take like the gold effect out by sanding and sanding and sanding. And in the outside, they put acid to make the oxidation process.
Like all previous collections I've seen and made in situ, these pieces aren't just about the design. They explore the geology, biology, materiality, and techniques of Portugal. And the candles are as much part of this wide-reaching journey as the candle holders themselves.
So he contacted Melbionisa, that it's a farm, a bee farm in the center of the country, and they make everything without using any chemicals, and they really protect the bees. So we learn a little about the process of how that you can only harvest the honey and the beeswax during 2 months in the year because of the weather conditions, if the bees needs to have a lot of energy to keep producing.
Making my way through the Design Week itinerary, I noticed a few things connecting the studios I visited. Not only was there a strong, multidisciplinary and collaborative feel to most of these ateliers, but in almost every case, there seemed to be a very strong connection between product and land. Be them foreigners or locals, designers were very much tapping into Portugal, its nature, traditions, and featuring the country as an important aspect of their work. My last stop for the day was Flores Textile Studio, an interior design and textile atelier run by Valentina Pilha and Emma Pucci, who are presenting their newest collection, Terra e Sal, which features a range of furniture, objects, clothing, which were the result of partnerships with 5 artisans and designers.
And so the starting point of this process, let's say, was this piece that we started with Oficina do Convento, because we were interested in this process of slow cooking of ceramic that is done with salt. So it's a very long process, ancient
so
technique.
Where did the salt go?
During the cooking, you add salt. And what's incredible is that you never know what the result is going to be. The samples we had seen had nothing to do with the result.
The ceramic pieces I see are nothing like what you'd expect from ceramics at all. There's something ashy, volcanic about them. And at first glance, I thought they were some sort of metal even.
So after these elements inspired these elements of fire, of earth and... Salt inspired the whole research that we did here. So these objects have been done with the ashes of this cooking. So this was the first piece, and after this salt inspired us to work with our linen that we produce with a family here in Portugal, north of Portugal. It's a small family that does the whole process of the linen, from the seed to the final fabric. And so we have collaborated with a stylist. But a real one, like a sculptor of clothing, asking her to make some essentials for in clothes. With our linen. And so this is the result. So everything is responding to each other. And here it's a totally history of design pieces. We are not designers, I think. We are architects. I'm interior architect, I'm as architect. But we really, I think there is a story to tell, you know, with objects and textile together.
And the nice story, I think,
during these years. At the beginning, maybe it was focused by textile and ceramic and wood. And now we are mixing more things and we are mixing more the connection.
All this mixing of ideas from ceramics to linen and furniture will culminate in a cocktail reception here at Floaty Studio on Friday night, where designers, artisans and audiences can have a mingle.
No, there will be a drink this Friday. Okay. And all these artisans present their own work and the work they did with us and the collaboration they did. Some they haven't met and finally they are meeting now and they want to do new things together. Maybe gathering the strength of all these artists, designers, artisans in Lisbon, and maybe all together to be able to... Now we feel we could all go abroad to show what is Lisbon proposing to everybody. So I think that would be the next step.
For Monocle, reporting from Lisbon Design Week, I'm Gaia Lutz.
Thank you, Gaia. And that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our guests today, Chris Chermak, Isabella Jewell and Lillian Fawcett. Today's show was produced by Tom Webb and researched by Helmi Pillai. Our sound engineer was Tamsin Howard. I'm Andrew Mullett here in London. The Daily returns at the same time on Monday. Thanks for listening and have a good weekend.